Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from Next Gen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley, your host for the next hour and a half here on the show that every Saturday on Premier Christian Radio brings Christians and non-Christians together. Well, that's usually the case anyway. Sometimes it's a Christian and a Christian to have some kind of a theological discussion. But today, it is the usual Christian-non-Christian discussion and a really interesting episode of the programme today. I'm joined by Oz Guinness, who's an internationally renowned speaker, author and social critic. And he's joining me, of course, for Unbelievable, the conference 2014 in just 2 weeks' time. Saturday, the 12th of July, Oz will be our keynote speaker and we're joined by a host of other well-known people, thinkers and speakers from around the world. William Lane Craig is going to be with us. And excitingly, we're going to be giving away to every single delegate at that conference a copy of a new DVD featuring three of his most well-known debates with atheists. So what more reason could you want to book in? Well, I'll give you another one. If you book two or more tickets, you'll get another free DVD courtesy of Biola, who are partnering with us on the conference this year. That's full of apologetics resources and talks and things. And it's all available by going to the website premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith to book in for this year's Unbelievable, the conference 2014, just 2 weeks away now. Really looking forward to meeting hundreds and hundreds of people who are coming along for this year's conference at Westminster Central Hall. And of course, all the seminars and topics and many guests who are going to be there as well. Do check out all the names, all the topics and all the details at premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. It's all about helping you to think through your faith and answer tough questions in a skeptical world. And so we're going to be trying to do that again today. And that's what we do every week here on the show. Bring together different voices. And let me introduce to you what we're talking about on today's programme. You're unbelievable. Well, welcome along, and we're looking forward to today's programme. I'm joined, as I've mentioned, by Oz Guinness, an author and social critic, founder of the Trinity Forum, and he'll be speaking at this year's Unbelievable, the conference. He's our keynote speaker, and one of the seminars he's leading is on Fool's Talk, Recovering the Art of Persuading Those Who Are Closed. And, well, we're going to be looking at the whole issue of faith and doubt and how we have those kinds of conversations on today's programme. Ed Atkinson is our other guest on today's show. He's a former Christian, a water engineer by background, but he lost his faith after struggling to feel like he really knew God on the basis of experience. And when he decided to check whether it was intellectually true, he found it wanting. So we're going to be having this discussion today on faith and doubt as Oz Guinness, my Christian guest, interacts with Ed. Why do people lose their faith and what kind of evidence are we looking for when it comes to people being open to the possibilities of Christian faith? A very good afternoon to you both, gentlemen.
Great pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you here, Ed, as well.
Thank you.
Let's just first of all say hi to Oz. Oz, great to have you back on the show. It's been a year or two since you were last with us, and you're a busy man. You fly around the world speaking at various events and things, but you've spent some more time recently here in the UK, haven't you? So
roughly 3 months a year over here.
But yeah.
So many of the world's issues are the same, whether you're in China or America or Europe. And so, you know, I discuss things like how do we live with deep differences, which is a global issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a privilege to travel.
And that's been a focus of your work in recent years. What kind of gets you up in the morning? What do you sort of live for when it comes to the various things that you're focusing on across the course of your life?
You know, I'm in my early 70s now, but for years I've been passionate about two things at least. One is trying to understand this crazy, fascinating modern world that we're in and what it's doing to us. Mm. So I love that. On the other hand, I love, and it's a privilege to be with you for that reason, making sense of the faith, because we're in a very skeptical age, and it's a privilege to make sense of the faith today in ways that are rational.
I know you're working on a book, essentially on recovering the ability of Christianity to speak into our culture and to be a sort of driving force for cultural revolution.
Well, that book's coming out in August, and it addresses the sort of gloom and doom in parts of the Christian community, because the church is shallow and not doing well today. But I argue simply that if we trust and live the gospel, you can see over the course of 2,000 years, it's probably the single greatest agent of changing personal lives and creating cultures and even a civilization, one of the most powerful forces in history. So I'm going back over 2,000 years of the Christian influence, looking at some of the incredible impact it's made.
Yeah, the Renaissance, if you like, and I think that's the working title.
The title.
It is the title. Great. Well, look out for that in August, Renaissance, Os Guinness's forthcoming book. One thing, though, you will be speaking on specifically at the conference is Fool's Talk, Recovering the Art of Persuading Those Who Are Closed. Do you want to give us a brief sketch of what you might be saying?
Well, put it like this. In the social sciences, they say we're in the grand age of apologetics. Mm. And they don't mean Christian apologetics. They mean in the day of the internet and so on. Mm. You know, I post, therefore I am.
Yeah.
Everyone's in the business of presenting themselves, selling themselves, arguing for themselves. Mm. Facebook's the daily me, and so on. And Christians who should be in the thick of communication, there's one central thing they miss. Christians are wonderful when people are open and interested and needy. Mm. But when they're not, if they're indifferent or hostile, often we don't know what to say. But you can see in the scriptures and down through Christian history, there's a minority tradition of persuaders.
Yes.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Persuasion. Does that mean we are essentially salesmen? I mean, when you talk about the art of persuasion, you might be talking about the person who calls you up trying to get you to change your electricity provider.
No, absolutely not. In other words, the 20th century did two bad things.
Yeah.
Used to be a noble idea, persuasion, a key part of, say, Greek rhetoric. And then on the one hand, you had communism and Nazism, where it was propaganda, political coercion. Mm. Mm. And on the other hand, you had the rise of psychology and consumerism, where it became those subtle, hidden persuaders that was highly manipulative. And the way I'm arguing for, we haven't time to get into now, is not that at all. In fact, I have an argument against some Christians who try and use sales techniques in evangelism. They don't allow any questions.
Yeah.
They want to get to the deal, which is the decision. And that's terrible. They manipulate. That's awful. But if you look at the Christian persuasion in its biblical terms, you invite people in and they see it for themselves.
Mm. Yes.
But that takes longer to explain.
Yes, well, that's another whole show in a way. But we look forward to hearing that. I'm going to be looking forward to sitting in on that session. If you want to find out more about the conference, as I've already mentioned, you can go to the website and book yourself in. Not long to go at all now till Unbelievable, the conference 2014. premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. Ed Atkinson is our other guest on today's programme. Ed, thank you for coming in.
And, thank you.
Very kind of you, because your name was passed to me by someone who's connected to this show and said, I think Ed would be an interesting person to have in. And here you are, not less than a few weeks later. But just give us a little background to yourself, Ed. You were a Christian at one time. Do you want to tell us how that happened, how you became a Christian?
Yes. So I was brought up in an atheist home. Mm-hmm. My sister became a Christian when I was an early teen. And then over the years, hearing from her, and I sort of had it on the radar. Mm. I went to an event at Grey Friars Church in Reading, and a couple of days later, so it was all very quick, I sort of made the commitment.
What kind of age were you at this
16.
Point? Okay, so this is sort of late teens. Yeah.
So then I was in a sort of charismatic style, Anglican church, and then a Baptist church of the same ilk in Henley-on-Thames. And I was very committed, very eager, as you said in the introduction, to know God. Mm. That was really my big driver.
Right.
And also to be kind of part of the team that was sort of producing good in the world. Mm. And so I was absolutely full on with that. Married Maggie, and it was all great. Two wonderful children. Mm. And then I was an elder for a while. But I was always living on hope that sometime I'd break through.
Mm-hmm. Break through to feeling the presence of God in some way that you didn't feel you'd had it before.
Yes, that's right. Because obviously in a charismatic setting, that is absolutely on the agenda. Mm. That it's not a dry, can read your Bible kind of faith. It's
very experiential.
Yes, experiential, and there's no thought of just sort of rationality is suspicious and don't even kind of consider what the Bible says, just go with your feelings. No, it's not that. But the heart of it is that God wants to know us, and we want to know God, and there's a relationship.
Mm-hmm. And that's dead right.
I mean, how long would you say you existed then in this sort of period? We're talking a couple of decades that you would have seen yourself as a Christian.
Right. Yeah. So I was kind of mid-30s when I eventually got to the point where I stood back and said, no, this is not working. I need to look at it from the outside. So I was eager for Christianity to be true, but it couldn't be true because I was experiencing it had to be true because it was objectively true.
Because, so give us sort of a little bit of a taste of what that journey involved, because you kind of were constantly looking, presumably, for an experience that would sort of validate, yes, this really is true, but you never quite felt like you got that experience. And at some point you said, I've actually got to step back from this and ask, is it actually true?
Yes. The word that jarred in what you've just said is an experience. Mm. It was experience. So okay. I wasn't after sort of God zapping me and falling over like all my kind of church colleagues were. Just that this was real and that God was there. That when I was praying, I wasn't sort of like praying to the ceiling. I used to go out for walks, for long walks for breakfast to be with God. I regularly came back seething with anger that I just couldn't get through. It was just, I was stuck with myself. And so I went forward for counselling. You know, do you remember healing of the emotions and or inner healing and the charismatic renewal, Toronto blessing, deliverance, anything going? I was jumping in both feet to sort of overcome what I saw was this blockage in me that was preventing God getting through.
What were you kind of hoping for, expecting? What would that experience, had it been realised, have looked like it for you? Would it have been a sort of an inner sense, a kind of something outside of you that would have confirmed that?
Inner sense, yeah.
Justin, I would say he was right.
Mm.
I mean, you look at, say, Pascal. He had a sort of nominal faith, and then the night of, he calls it fire, 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 not the God of the philosophers, but of Abraham, Isaac. He broke through to that moment where it was thoroughly intellectual, great mind, and yet it was palpably real. And, of course, I am who I am. At the heart of the Jewish and Christian faiths, there's the reality of a divine presence. And obviously, for whatever reason, I don't know, we've only just met, you never got through to that, which to me is sad, but one can.
Well, we'll come back to it because we want to sort of pick that up. I mean, I'd be interested in hearing from your perspective, Oz, your faith. Would you describe it as having had this very experiential aspect as well as obviously being thought through and intellectual at another level too?
Well, I came to faith through thinking. Now, my family heritage is Christian. Arthur Guinness, my ancestor, came to faith through the preaching of John Wesley and built Christian principles, generosity, responsibility, into the firm. Mm. But in my own life, you know, when the communists came to China where we were living, we were under house arrest for 2 years, and then my parents were kept, and I was allowed to come back to England. So all my teenage years, I didn't have my parents. So they clearly loved me and prayed for me, but I didn't have them. Mm. And my own journey to faith was really through an intellectual journey. On the one hand, I read Nietzsche and Sartre, and my hero in those days was Camus, Albert Camus. I loved him. Not Sartre, who's a cold fish. I still read Nietzsche. And on the other side, people like Dostoevsky, Pascal, G.K. Chesterton, C.S. Lewis. And eventually, after 3 or 4 years of reading this sort of debate, I was finally convinced the Christian faith was true.
Convinced in your head at that point?
Yes, but in such a real way, I've never split those two.
Right.
My family is charismatic.
Right.
But I think, now, you had in, the say, Toronto, you mentioned, Ed, a lot of weirdness.
Mm-hmm.
Put it mildly there, the roaring of lions and things like that, and a lot of good things too. But I'm unashamedly in favor of both truth and the experience of the power of the Holy Spirit.
Sure.
And without the latter, the former would be dry.
Dry. Mm.
But without the former, the latter would often be rather dangerously contentless.
Can go in off in different directions that sort of need. Well, okay, well, that's helpful to sort of hear that level that your faith has always then had that, if you like, direct experiential aspect to it, Oz.
We must.
And we must have it. So why, for some people like Ed, does that never seem to materialize?
Well, I don't know enough of Ed's story to know why. And obviously the first step in talking to anyone, and Ed and I have only just met, is literally, tell me your story.
Mm.
You know, I mean, you said you grew up as an atheist, and, you know, I'd have to ask how it all happened. Because, you know, you've seen my book on doubt, which I wrote many, many years ago. But often there's some root of the source of doubt which needs to be addressed. There's nothing wrong with doubts at all. They're a kind of halfway house between belief and unbelief or skepticism. But you can resolve a doubt. It's a halfway house, and it can go back to belief, or left unresolved, it can go on to unbelief and skepticism. But you've got to know why it is, and Ed, we don't know each other well enough to know anything of the reasons for that. And I'd be most interested.
Yeah. But obviously there's the other alternative, and that is that God doesn't exist, and this is all something we're generating in our own minds when we're Christians.
Yeah, and that's the conclusion you eventually did come to then.
Yes, that's right. It was long, I couldn't say painful, but it was a long process of reading, you know, N.T. Wright and lots of Christian books and on the other side, and thinking, and eventually I got to the point where I said, okay, there's a tiny bit of evidence here, but really just not enough to base my life on. So I kind of put it all on one side after about 6-7 years of this.
Mm-hmm.
And then more recently, I've got interested again and kind of looked at it a lot more clearly. And now I'm, you know, I'm still an agnostic in that I feel I'm open-minded, but the chances of God being real to me are vanishingly small.
I mean, so you see yourself as sort of atheist / agnostic now at this point, but do you feel like you've in any sense lost anything in the process of losing your faith, or do you feel that actually I've gained something because I'm no longer sort of searching after this elusive experience or whatever?
I've lost a bit. The community of a church is excellent, and I have to sort of applaud the people who love me and maybe who I am, and you know, the confidence I have and that sort of thing. There's a lot of good. But it was such a relief to be free from this tension of trying to believe something that wasn't believable. And initially, obviously, I didn't disbelieve. I just, you know, that tension of trying to was taken off me.
Mm.
I think a big thing in church life is that you are on the inside. You're going to heaven, and your colleague and the desk next to you isn't. And it creates a barrier between you. So I didn't really kind of sense I was part of the wider community in that full way. And that was just a breath of fresh air to sort of feel I'm part of everything. When I'm not trying to.
You felt somehow slightly like you were within a bubble that was hard to break out of then when you were a Christian, as it were. You felt like that isolated you from the rest of the world.
Yes, the church is pretty open. We weren't, you know, it was not these churches where the creche is sort of run through the week and they have their own school and that sort of thing where you are. It's not that sort of bubble. But it was more in the theory of it. That we are the chosen, and we're trying to be in the world but not of the world. And that just creates a massive barrier between between you and
But there's those a lot more to it than just community. I mean, you could join Jehovah's Witness community or a Communist Party communities. You can find community everywhere. But for me, knowing Jesus touches so many things, not only in the worldview, but in life. I mean, I knew as a student Bertrand Russell. When I was at Oxford, I conversations with A.J. Ayer, one of the greatest of the 20th century atheists, and Christopher Hitchens, I knew in Washington. But if you look at the whole worldview, I mean, if we don't know each other, but say human dignity, how do you justify that? Or a hope when things look really bleak, or the answers to things like evil. You know, the knowing Jesus and the light he throws on life, far more than community. It's an incredibly intellectually and emotionally exhilarating experience of facing life. So it's not that we're in a bubble over against other people's bubble. You know, it is a different way of seeing it, say, from a Buddhist or a Hindu or a humanist. But the differences are magnificent. Now, you didn't break through, I agree. And that clearly is part of the nub of the problem.
Or the nub of the problem is that God doesn't exist. I wasn't sure when you were chatting then if you were like presenting kind of an argument for Christianity or just talking from your own.
But part of the argument, I'm a great believer in the simple principle, contrast is the mother of clarity. You know, I remember when I was in my 20s, I studied under a guru, very sophisticated, powerful. But when I broke through and saw the logic of Hinduism, say, why the caste system, or why don't they have a high view of human dignity, I reeled back with an incredible sense of gratitude and wonder. And same with talking to the great atheists. I mean, Hitchens used to say, why religion poisons everything. I'm sure that's not your extreme position. But I mean, it's just rankly wrong. You look at the 20th century, far more people were killed by atheist regimes with atheist leaders than all the worst of the persecutions in history, which were anti-Christian, the Christian persecutions. And so you take something like Auschwitz. Why did so many intellectuals commit suicide in Auschwitz? Well, quite clearly, they couldn't stand the failure to answer the question, why? So for me, it's far more than community. I love my Christian community. But it's the whole sense of knowing Jesus and the light it throws on every part of life.
I mean, it sounds very much like what you're describing is that classic C.S. Lewis quote of I believe in Christianity as I believe in the sun, not just because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. And in that sense, a worldview is something where you...
It's a lens.
It's a lens, and you see the world, and it makes sense of the world. And then yours is obviously the Christian worldview and Christ at the centre of that. You on the other hand, Ed, I think at some level you never got to that position, presumably, of feeling like Christianity explains stuff around me. It kind of makes sense of the world. You were constantly trying to make the world make sense in light of this belief you were doggedly trying to hold on to.
No, I was absolutely on board that it did make sense of everything. And my own personal struggles of not knowing God wasn't the kind of focus of everything.
Okay.
I sort of got on with being a human being and getting involved with the church, and there was heaps to worry about, the youth group that I was running and everything. So there's no...
But Ed's central question is good. It's reality.
That's right.
Reality.
Yes.
Not just an experience, as you said, but the reality of knowing God palpably and real. And that is the central issue. And too many Christians don't actually know that. In other words, they live with just words or ethics or church going without ever breaking through to that reality, which is the heart of it.
Yeah.
So your question was a good one.
So when you talked about the C.S. Lewis and the sunshine, you know, that is a discussion, an explanation of a worldview. So I would sort of, instead of the sunshine would be the enlightenment, I would guess, or reason. And by that, I see everything, and it makes absolute perfect sense of everything in a way that Christianity doesn't.
No, it doesn't. I mean, why did the enlightenment fail? Why have we gone to the postmodern world? People have rejected the Christian faith, but they've gone from modernism, which put reason at the heart of everything, and scientific materialism, and we're in the world of postmodernism. And all the latest books, like Terry Eagleton's book just came out this year, is on the search for the God substitutes, because reason and rationalism or scientism, they don't answer the big questions. For instance, I imagine, I don't know you at all, you adore your wife and kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Through scientific materialism, you couldn't explain love. You take something like Freedom, the latest book by Sam Harris, Freedom is an illusion. So reason simply, science simply, they're wonderful. I love reason. I thank God for science. But by themselves, they're not big enough to explain even science.
They're not big enough to explain these questions of meaning.
That's what I'm saying. In other words, you said you put your faith in reason and it did what God did. No, it doesn't. Reason isn't enough.
Enough. What they do is that they explain why we have this inner urge to make everything mean something. But there's no reason why it should. And
so, in a sense, the reason has taken away the validity of even asking these questions of why and what are we here for, and is there such a thing as love?
Sorry, you have to say that again.
Well, I was just wondering, I mean, you said they explain why we search for meaning. Is that what you're saying? Science,
yes.
Science and reason help us to do. In that sense, are you saying that they answer the question by saying, well, it's just a biological urge, it's just a sort of, it is an illusion in the end, free will and so on?
Yeah, of course, That's just so obvious to me. And we have massive evolutionary advantages by looking for meaning and explanation in things. And we've seen it in the early days of the volcano. And instantly, every society would experience that, would put an agent behind it, that they would assume that the meaning behind that is some big agent. And this is where the famous God of the Gaps things come from. And the more that science explains things, the more that the agency behind it, behind what we observe and in the world, is explained away.
We're going to come back to this in a moment and appreciate hearing your thoughts on that, Odds. But we're going to take a quick break and say, if you're listening and you'd like to get in touch about anything you've heard so far, you're welcome to do that. Email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget we're on all the social media sites as well, at UnbelievableJB to follow me on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page, and find all those links and more, including, of course, links to my guests and the conference at the Unbelievable webpage. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We'll be back in just a moment's time. My conversation partners today, Oz Guinness and Ed Atkinson. We're talking about faith and doubt and what it takes to believe in God and Christianity these days.
Do the Bible and science really contradict each other? Is there really a historical Adam and Eve? These are only a few of the questions that seem to indicate an apparent conflict between science and faith, and this is why Reasons to Believe exists. RTB's mission is to demonstrate that sound reason and scientific research consistently support, rather than erode, confidence in the truth of the Bible. Our work shows how the record of nature and the record of Scripture reveal the God of the Bible as Creator, Lord, and Savior. Find out how you also can give a skeptical world reasons to believe. Visit us today at reasons.org.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the show today, part of our Faith Explored range of programming every Saturday afternoon. Hope you are enjoying this Saturday afternoon. And if you want to catch up on today's show, perhaps you've joined us halfway through and you thought, that sounds really interesting, I'd like to listen again. Go to premier.org.uk/unbelievable to find out more and to follow up on my guests today. We're talking today about faith and doubt with Oz Guinness and Ed Atkinson. Oz, of course, an author and social critic. He's speaking at this year's Unbelievable Conference on Saturday the 12th of July, coming up very soon here in the UK in central London. If you want to find out more information about that, as ever, premier.org.uk/reasonable faith. You can find the full list of speakers and so on at that website, all the topics, a fantastic array of seminars going on throughout the day at Westminster Central Hall, Saturday the 12th of July, from the morning. You can get in pretty early from about 9:30 in the morning, and we'll be finishing up about 4:35 in the afternoon, and just so much on offer at the conference this year. So I hope you can go and look at the rest of the speakers, William Lane Craig, Tanya Walker, David Robertson, Jeff Swearink, Craig Hazen, Clay Jones. There are more that I have failed to mention, but go and check it out. premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. Well, Oz is here, of course, to talk with Ed Atkinson. He's our non-Christian guest on the show today. He's a former Christian, a water engineer by background, but lost his faith after struggling to feel like he really knew God on the basis of experience. When he checked it out intellectually, he didn't feel it held water in the end. And so where we got to, gentlemen, was really talking about this fact that you felt science and reason provided a better foundation for explaining the world. And Oz, you came back to say, well, hang on, what about these questions of meaning? That's not what science and reason themselves explain. And you essentially answered there, Ed, well, they explain where we get these urges from to have meaning and so on. We can get a naturalistic evolutionary explanation for this desire for love and cooperation and these sorts of things. And this is the point at which I was going to bring you back in before we had to go to a break. So what's your thinking on this? Has Ed got a point
here? Well, let me expand it. Yes, of course he has a point. I was in Cairo recently, and friends were telling me the huge spike in atheism following the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi. And he went into a cafeteria at the University of Cairo and counted 47 people all reading Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion.
How extraordinary.
Now, expand on that. The simple reason is, whenever you have bad religion or shallow religion, or you were mentioning case of anti-intellectual religion in American schools and so on, wherever you have bad religion, it boosts atheism. And it's true that the Christian church too, not just Islam, is at a low ebb today. And so there are many, many reasons why it's very natural to become an atheist. But I would, if we had longer, and I hope I'll get to know you, Ed, in the future, not today, press at two levels. One would be, where does the logic of your present position go? And I think even what you said now, you should be a lot more skeptical about great things. For example, do you have as an atheist a grounding for love or human dignity or freedom? And many of these things, or hope, many of these things which are incredibly important to human life, do you have a grounding? And I would, if we had time, press you that direction. Mm. The other way I'd press, if we were friends and had more time, was to look at experiences in your own life, which if you think about them, my mentor calls those signals of transcendence, experiences. For instance, people say there are no absolutes. But when they come up against a real injustice, they say that's absolutely wrong. And they're right. Intuitively, they know some things in life require an absolute to judge them. My friend calls them signals of transcendence. So there's a negative route to talk about. What does the logic of your position lead to? And I think you'd have to be a lot more skeptical. Would you bring your kids up skeptical about meaning, about love? And so I bet you wouldn't. Equally, well, I think there are things in your life which go beyond the present atheism.
Yes. Well, it's not particularly helpful to my kids because my wife's still a Christian and we were keen not to sort of give a dissonant upbringing. Now they're adults. That sort of frees me up much more to do the exploring I've been doing over the last few months. But
put it way beyond your kids. Take a whole culture. Say the whole of Britain became atheists in the Richard Dawkins way.
Okay.
What would be the effect on things like human dignity or Sam Harris, his friend, freedom? Is freedom an illusion for you?
Yes. I think it
all
is.
Right. Well, that'll have incredible consequences for justice, for all sorts of things, if you consistently follow through from that. Now, in a Jewish and Christian view, you have a very different position. People made in the image of God are made capable of responsible freedom. Anyway, my point is just,
I need to sort of briefly answer this, but that all our motivations are incredibly strong and they come from our heritage as social animals.
Mm. But they're all deterministic in that way.
Yes, that's right.
Modern atheism is highly deterministic. So once again, you're undermining freedom.
I mean, Ed, I'd be interested in kind of hearing why is it that you feel if we've got this explanatory framework for why we do the things we do and the things we feel, do you feel at some level that then explains those things? So if we are acting in a loving way because we've been genetically programmed to do that because it's the best way for making sure we reproduce and so on, is that an explanation then of this thing we call love?
At heart, yes. And it's fantastic. It's wonderful. We're part of the big nature.
But you've just used a word there, loaded with meaning, called wonderful.
Yes.
What's wonderful about it if it's actually just a kind of inevitable result of chemicals and genetics?
Well, I suppose it's all a matter of viewpoint. That if we kind of view the Earth from another galaxy, we just see the essential meaninglessness in the whole of what's going on the Earth. But we are agents in it, and we're having a wonderful time exploring it. But, you know, if you push and push and push, at heart it's meaningless.
But so you've gone for the, in a sense, the Nietzschean sort of view, which is ultimately it's all... Ultimately, there is no meaning to be grasped. We're sort of... But we can have a wonderful time in the meantime?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's right.
And we just happen to have the luck of being born in the West where we're prosperous, but say someone in Bangladesh or Syria or Iraq today, just bad luck for them, is it? I mean, the whole universe, even Richard Dawkins says the whole universe is here by a stroke of good luck.
I don't know about the whole universe, but
well, that's his position as an atheist.
Yes.
I mean, Bertrand Russell, we come from a chance collocation of atoms.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue against that. It's just sort of what flavour you put on it we're talking about.
No, but the more than flavours, the flavours have consequences.
Well, you're trying to get somewhere by I shouldn't say that. You are emphasising the chance aspect of it. We don't know how many societies there are like us in the universe we've got. We don't know how many universes there are either.
Well, that's true. We've all got to be agnostic on that.
Yes.
Let's focus this down on something in particular then. We've been talking about love, okay. And I suppose my question was going to be for you, Ed. It doesn't sound quite as satisfactory for me to say to my children, I love you because I'm genetically programmed to do that because that will make sure that my genetic material... And it doesn't explain a lot of what actually happens in real life of altruistic love, for instance, is hard to explain in that way. And a lot of people, you know, I think they would see what you've adopted in place of Christian faith as in some ways very cold and sterile and depressing in the end, if ultimately it all boils down to what Richard Dawkins calls we're dancing to the tune of our DNA, basically. I mean, yeah. But for you, obviously, that's not sort of the conclusion.
Well, I embrace everything. That I'm this agent. I have this drive in me to be part of the community, to love my children, my family. And I'm just loving the ride. But if I have to stand right back, it is meaningless. And, you know, that's just the way it is. You kind of follow the truth to wherever follow the evidence to wherever it leads you.
But Ed, and to say the whole thing is meaningless is incredibly radical. And very few people, I mean, even some of the great philosophers, William James and others, they talked about an as-if worldview. The universe is meaningless, but we have to live as if there was meaning. And it basically a form of fiction and bad faith.
Yeah, well, that's why religion's so sticky. That's why there's so much of it about. That's why it took me 7 years of heartache and thinking to sort of wriggle free from it all.
But I bet you don't live as if your world is meaningless in, say, your work, let alone your family. If you did, you'd live very different. Well, you're actually living off a strong cultural memory in Britain, which is towards the end now. If we would really adopt a Nietzschean or a Sartrean or whatever worldview or Richard Dawkins worldview, Britain would be a much more different place, much more cutthroat, for example. Why care for the poor? Why look after your neighbor? And there are many things still taken for granted that owe everything to Jesus. I mean, modern medicine came from the church. No one has built more hospitals than, say, the Catholic community. And it all went back to the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Well, it's... You say it all comes from Christianity. Christianity got it from our genes and has sort of transmitted it to us.
Even Richard Dawkins wouldn't say that.
Well, I don't have to speak for him.
Which great atheist would say that? You can't say that take, for instance, the radical demand of Jesus to his followers, love your enemy. Things like that don't simply come from genes. You can't say that. In other words, we're focusing maybe on one part only.
Yeah, I'd like to move on.
One challenge would be to follow through the logic of what you're saying in every area. Justin, you mentioned love. One of my best friends in America was a Harvard grad, and his father was attorney general. He was an atheist. The turning point for him was when he heard this sort of discussion. He was hitchhiking in Spain with a couple who were both dons at Cambridge, and they were talking about this, and he turned to the husband. He was an atheist. He turned to the husband, and he said, when you take, I don't know what her name was, in your arms tonight and say, I love you, are you saying it's just a chemical interaction of your chemistry? He said, of course, that's all it is. And his wife started to cry. And he realized the logic of what he was saying just didn't fit things like love and humanness.
Maybe a final comment on this from Ed, and we will move on to a different aspect of your story.
I think Oz is making a mistake of saying it's sort of just our chemistry. There's so much in life where something simple generates something complicated. So that the simplicity of electrons whizzing about in a computer generate the fantastic video that you're watching or that kind of thing. There is just by saying what the kind of mechanism is behind it is not fully describing the complex results of that.
And the difference is made by the author of the book or of the...
The computer film director or whatever.
I've no idea if you are a creationist, but I would probably doubt it.
No, I believe in creation.
Yeah, okay. So evolution is the ultimate or easy to discuss example of this.
Let me
finish because I'm not trying to make
it.
Just I'm using it more of as an analogy or example of how wonderful complexity and beauty emerges from such a simple, dry process as kind of genetics.
But then when you say wonderful complexity and beauty, you're using all these value-laden terms. And I don't think that the evolutionary process alone explains what counts as wonderful and beautiful and so on. That's something we sort of impose on it from a different realm almost, isn't it? So at one level, I understand what you're saying, but at the same time, you keep using words which... almost undercut what you're saying at the same time, because it feels like you can't explain those concepts in and of, you know, just by using a cold rationalistic sort of scientific process.
Well, I thought I have.
Process.
Can I go back in the discussion?
But beauty, you said it's a beautiful thing to be able to witness evolution producing complex things from simple things and so on. But what is it that you would say is the beauty in that? What do you mean when you say that thing is beautiful? Because for me... just simply saying what it is, that doesn't actually tell you that it's beautiful.
Well, it interacts with my emotions in that particular way.
So in the end, it is actually still about what's going on in your brain chemically that's making you think it's beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, again, then makes me wonder, well, what makes your version of beauty the right one, as opposed to someone else who thinks beautiful is making sure that a white Aryan race dominates the entire world and... sort of, you know, conquers it for their purposes. What would make your view of beauty the right one as opposed to someone else's?
I think we need to go back to talk about the worldviews, which is what I'm hoping to get onto next.
Well, let's talk about worldviews. we're having a really interesting discussion here, and we're talking about doubt, faith, worldviews, what colours, in a sense, our whole view of nature and the world around us. And my guests are Oz Guinness and Ed Atkinson. I'm Justin Brierley with you for Unbelievable this afternoon. If you want to get in touch, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And you can email in, you can get us on Facebook and Twitter and so on. All the links available, of course, as well as links to my guests and the Unbelievable conference from the webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Do continue here on Premier Christian Radio. We're talking with Ed Atkinson and Oz Guinness.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
But there is so much we wanted to cover, and already time is running away with us. Let's talk about worldviews, and particularly, I think one thing was in your journey, Ed, out of Christian faith. You sort of did this thing of looking at it from an intellectual perspective and deciding, no, in the end, I don't think this holds water. Now, one level, I think it's a very brave thing to do, because I think a lot of people will tenaciously hold on to their worldview. Because obviously there are all kinds of reasons apart from the truth or not of it to do that, your context and everything else. And I think your view is that Oz as a Christian, you now as an atheist, you've both got a worldview, and you're likely to interpret the evidence you get for that favourably in one direction or the other. So would it be true to say that now you're more likely to, as it were, data that matches your experience to sort of take that on board, and data that doesn't to kind of treat that differently?
Now, this is something that's in all of us. I'd love to actually talk about my own experience recently, where I don't know if you heard of that BBC Horizon programme where they introduced this 5-2 diet about 2 years ago.
So this is the diet where you basically starve yourself for 2 days of the week and eat normally the rest of the days.
Yes, that's right. And the kind of science behind it, as presented in the BBC Horizon programme, is to do with combating the diseases of ageing, sort of the cancers and the heart disease and stuff. And I thought this was great, so I went for it, and I've committed myself to it.
To the 5-2 diet?
Yeah.
How's it going so far?
Oh, it's been great.
Okay.
But
We've got a few people in the office doing it as well, and it seems to have made quite a difference. Actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then we just happened to see it on iPlayer, and I watched it again, and I thought, oh, wonderful. And so I looked up on Wikipedia and NHS Direct and that sort of stuff, what the latest research is, to see if, you know, because it was still a bit vague. And I was reading through all this research, and I just sensed myself, whenever there was some data that was saying that the diet really isn't going to do you any good and that kind of thing, I was resisting it. I was filtering it out. And because I've been thinking about these things, I suddenly just caught myself doing this and realising that I am so biased.
You've got a vested interest in that diet working because you've been doing it.
Absolutely. Yes, because I've... Exactly. Once you do it, that is a commitment. That was one of the chapters in your book, Lars, that about to remove doubts in your life. If you commit to it and do it, then that kind of reduces the doubts, almost like Pascal's wager.
And you would take that analogy and obviously apply it to Christian faith.
I don't think it's an analogy. This is a scientifically known effect. Confirmation bias and this big area of cognitive dissonance.
Where, of course, that cuts both ways. Hindus do it, atheists do it, Christians do it, Jews do it. In other words, you have to, knowing that, lean against it and be convinced that what you believe, when you come to believe, is true.
Yeah.
In other words, there's two big questions for a worldview. Is it adequate? Does it answer all the questions? Two, is it true? And a lot of people just skip that second one and just believe for various reasons. And unless they know it's true, they're in trouble. Because, you know, it's actually philosophy's point. I've forgotten the name of the theory. It's Gresham's theory or something. You can believe anything against all the evidence if you want, for psychological reasons.
That's right.
Yeah. So the question is, have you considered why you believe it is true? But I was focusing earlier on the adequacy, because, you know, there's two big questions to ask about a worldview. One is, comparatively, and the other is how critical it is, because if you adopt a worldview, any worldview, it will affect what you see and it will affect what you don't see. So, for instance, atheists, you know, Max Weber called them tone deaf. Einstein used to say they don't pick up the music of the spheres. Their worldview denies there's anything else apart from the reality you can see and so on. Whereas for most of the world religions, even some that I would say were false, they were in touch with something that was supernatural, went beyond the natural. So, you know, I know that a bird or a bear or a bat can hear things I can't hear. Well, atheism is a kind of way of shutting off parts of reality, so you could never see them in a million years if you adopt that worldview. So it shapes what you see and what you don't see.
So you're saying we need to be careful in a sense of it cuts both ways, as
absolutely.
You say.
And I said earlier, human dignity.
Yeah. Well, I can feel pretty smug in this conversation because I've changed my worldview twice in my life, and particularly over a lot of careful thought from being a Christian back to now an atheist. And so I've got no...
You feel you've done that work of addressing your biases and
yes, that's right.
Having every reason, I suppose, to hold on to Christian faith, but eventually going against it. I suppose in the end, what was important for you was whether it was true, not whether it was convenient or comfortable or reassuring or whatever to believe in Christianity. And for that, I would applaud you, because I think Oz would agree whether something is true is fundamental, regardless of its other aspects of its value. But I mean, I suppose the question is, how you know, at what point can you say I've exhausted all the options on this and I'm sort of safe now to sort of say I reject this particular thing? And as you say, psychologically, I suppose there could be other reasons coming in why you're now more inclined to reject evidences for Christianity now that you, as it were, find yourself on the other side.
Yeah, that's very fair. Perfect.
But, Ed, you used the word smug. I hope you're not smug. Because even in the short time we've been talking, you're giving evidences of things that would worry me. On the one hand, you said if you're really logical, the world is meaningless.
You're
not living like that, though. I bet you aren't. I don't
no,
know.
No, of course I'm not. What I understand is that...
But where do you ground that meaning? And I bet there are all sorts of things you're actually assuming that if you're really a radical atheist, you've got no right to. And that's where...
No, it's no problem at all. I've sort of cut you off because this isn't going anywhere. I quite get it that it's up to me to make my own meaning in life, and I've embraced that and I've done that.
So it's a self-made meaning for you, which could well be a fiction. It's totally...
Yeah, I know it's a fiction.
It's a do-it-yourself meaning.
Yes, I know it's a fiction.
Well,
what's the problem?
If you've ever read Nietzsche, he used to get really angry and scornful, say, of George Eliot here in England. He called her a progressive windbag of odious optimism because he said, if God is dead, atheism is true, the whole world changes. And he was mad with people like Eliot who said, well, God is dead and everything's the same. But actually, we're living in the twilight of a Christian country, and many of the things we take for granted, I go back to, say, the current issue with atheism is human dignity. They are not giving the grounds of human dignity. John Gray, here at in London, says that the optimistic humanists are parasites on the Jewish and Christian view of human dignity. And if you take the atheist view, look what it's done in the 20th century. Or the Hindu view, they have got no grounds for human dignity. In other words, when we see the consequences socially, practically, not just in an individual life, but a whole culture, you'll see that to say it's meaningless, you can't be smug. The world will change.
Well, I wasn't being smug about that. I think you've kind of gone back in the conversation, and I want to sort of press you more on the current worldview discussion we're having.
Yeah, and this issue that... I mean, we're running out of time, so we'll carry on for 10 minutes or so in a moment's time. But the issue for you is that you feel not enough Christians, presumably, for you do this job of assessing their biases and how willing they are to open themselves up to the possibility it's not true.
Yes, There's no moral aspect to this, that if Christians want to be Christians, there's nothing in me would want to stop them. When religion gets completely divorced from reason, then things get dangerous.
Point, I agree with you. Socrates talks about the examined life, you know, and St. Augustine talked about the thought through life. And he argues the Christians think in coming to believe, and they believe in thinking. So when faith parts company with reason, that's disastrous. And there's far too much of that today. So on that issue, let's shake hands and thoroughly agree. That is not the best of the Christian faith. I believe in a faith that you know who you believe and trust, you know what you believe in the light of that, and you know why you believe what you believe. So let's be clear on that. An anti-intellectual, unthinking, obscurantist, dogmatic faith without, that's terrible. That is not a proper Christian faith.
So what I would want to know is how you are sure that you're free from this confirmation bias, this cognitive dissonance problem, that.
Let's allow Oz to answer that in a moment's time. And leave that question hanging just for a moment. And if you'd like to offer your own answer to that question, how do you know that you've really objectively assessed your worldview? Be you atheist, Christian, or something else? Be interested to hear from you today. Give you the ways of getting in touch again in a moment's time, and we'll be hearing some of your feedback to previous week's programming at the end of today's show as well. We've talked about faith in various different ways over the last few weeks, so it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on this. It's Justin Brierley with you for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. My guests today are Oz Guinness and Ed Atkinson.
Was Jesus really raised from the dead? How can we know that God exists? How do we explain evil, pain and suffering in the world? And can faith be reconciled with modern science? Few universities are bold enough to answer yes to all these questions, but California's Biola University is premier amongst them. Biola University offers distance learning graduate degrees in theology, science, and apologetics that answer the toughest questions people ask about your faith. So to get the confidence you need to stand for Christ in a cynical age, visit biola.edu/apologetics. That's biola.edu/apologetics.
Welcome back. It's the third part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, part of our Faith Explored range of programming. And don't forget that you can hear The Profile straight after today's program at 4 o'clock. And today it's US gospel artist Avery Sunshine. Lady T Tolu is talking to him a little bit later on this afternoon. So listen out for that from 4 till 5. Next week on Unbelievable, you're going to be hearing a Mormon discussion. It's ex-Mormon Lynn Wilder, who was recently here in the UK on a speaking tour. She's joining me to debate Mormon apologist Michael Flournoy. So that will be an unmissable one, because Lynn, as if you heard my brief interview with her a few weeks ago, really was, if you like, quite high ranking in the Latter-day Saints Church. She taught at Brigham Young University. And she's got a really interesting story of how she then left that behind and adopted Orthodox biblical Christianity. And so she's going to be in discussion with Michael Flournoy and various Latter-day Saint doctrines around the Bible, the Book of Mormon, salvation, Joseph Smith and all of that stuff. So an unmissable discussion next week if you're into those kinds of issues. Hope you can come back at the same time next week. And again, just a reminder that if you want to find out about the conference coming up in 2 weeks' time now and book your place, get hold of the free DVD and so on, then do go to premier.org.uk/reasonable faith. If you want to actually visit today's show and find out more about my guests today, of course you can go to the website of Unbelievable itself, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and you can find lots and lots of past programs there as well, and links to further resources, videos, articles and whatnot. And we'll be hearing some of your feedback in a short moment's time. We had a bulging mailbag, a real slew of emails in on last week's show, which was the issue of suffering and evil. Clay Jones of Biola University was debating that with atheist philosopher Richard Norman. So after we finished up our discussion today between Oz Guinness and Ed Atkinson, my guests on today's show, we'll be hearing some of your feedback.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding this conversation between Oz Guinness and Ed Atkinson this afternoon, we've been talking about faith and doubt and Ed's own journey from Christian faith to doubting to finally abandoning his faith altogether. And we've talked a great deal about how we ground our worldview at all. And Ed's been very upfront about the fact that ultimately he does believe that the logical conclusions of an atheist view of the world are that, that there is no ultimate meaning, that we are here by chance. But we sort of just embrace that and live in that, and we're as happy as we can be within that, I suppose. Oz Guinness pushing back on whether we can really make any sense of any of our values and beliefs if that really is the ultimate place we're at when it comes to atheism. Well, be interested in hearing your thoughts as well. If you want to get in touch, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk via email. And do make sure to check out the website where you can find more on my guests today, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. But we've been talking about latterly this confirmation bias issue, and how do any of us know that we're really putting our beliefs to the test? You've spoken of the importance there, Oz, of having a thinking faith. Obviously, that's something you've championed for many, many years. But Ed asked that question before we went to the break. And you want to just repeat it once more for us, Ed, so that those who have maybe just joined us can get hold of it, and we'll let Oz answer.
Yeah. So can I sort of ramble a bit first?
Go on then. Yes.
We've got this discussion group in town, and for sort of skeptics and believers. And one of my friends said how he was certain of his faith because of the evidence of the resurrection.
Okay.
And so I asked him, well, have you actually read any books by people who argue against the resurrection? And he hadn't. So,
he'd read books, as it were, for the Christian case for the resurrection, but he hadn't read books that sort of try to dismantle the case.
Absolutely, that's right.
Right,
yeah.
And so this is an example of confirmation bias.
Yes, that's right. And then the cognitive dissonance is where, when it's sort of a psychological effect that's been researched for 50, 60 years now, where if you believe something and then there's evidence that is contrary to that, it gives you this deep inner turmoil, and you do everything you can to reduce that turmoil by dismissing the new evidence rather than by changing your beliefs.
Sure. And I think this is true of even scientific theories. Mm-hmm. They say they take a generation to be overturned because people are inevitably invested in their particular view of the world and their theory and so on.
That's right. And there's a good aspect to that. Yeah. That if we change our worldview every 6 months, that it would do us a lot of harm.
I suppose the question to you then is could, would you be willing to even admit contrary evidence? You're in your early 70s, as you said at the start of the show. You spent your whole life preaching Christ and the relevance. So at some level, are you not sort of completely, enveloped?
Well,
now
let's say Ed's point is true as a potential danger, but it cuts both ways. In other words, you could be an atheist or a Christian, a Jew, Hindu, whatever, and that very same thing would happen. Now, the key point is, though, you said a confirmation bias. In other words, you're saying about someone who's come to a belief. Now, I would argue that the truth issue has to come in before that, when you're coming to a belief. So as I see, a thinker's rate of faith always starts with questions. Something you use the word cognitive dissonance. A seeker is someone who has a question because what they believed before didn't satisfy, and now they're looking. They're on the road. Step two is a time for answers. Having had the questions, they want an answer this time that's adequate. Stage three is a time for evidences. Now, that's when a lot of people skip the truth question. I've got a problem. I believe in Jesus. They don't say, is it true? And things like pragmatism. I believe in it because it works. I believe in it because I like the experience. Those are inadequate. You've got to believe in it, finally, because it is true. And that means knowing how you can look to see that it's true. Now, that isn't a comfortable thing. You take someone like C.S. Lewis, who searched for 20 years. He got upset when he began to think it was true because he said, if there's a God, he is the great interferer. And you can see that in many people's lives. Rather than something they want, They're uncomfortable.
Ask him the question again. He hasn't answered it.
Okay. Well,
yes, I have. It was what got Lewis over that was his conviction. It was true. So you come to faith. Then, to pick up your point, you have to be open to every challenge.
And do you feel you are open to every challenge, Oz? Can you sort of say, with hand on heart?
I talk on a lot of university questions. If I'm asked a question I've never met before, I will go back and really think it through. I don't know all the answers to everything.
It's almost inconceivable to think of you, Oz, losing your faith at this point in your journey, if you like. But are you saying that it's not impossible, as it were? There could be something that if it was shown that Jesus absolutely did not rise from the dead, that would be an end to your Christian
faith? Absolutely. Of course it would. Of course it would. But my experience has been the other way around. As I said, I studied under a guru. I've lived in a Buddhist culture. You know, I've known many of the great atheists. Mm. The more I've looked into the alternatives and checked out, too, the truth claims of Jesus, I'm more convinced now, partly intellectually in a profound way, but partly, Ed, the thing you missed experientially. In other words, knowing the power of God through the Holy Spirit is something incredibly real.
Obviously, if those two combine, that's a powerful driver for faith.
Absolutely, but I'm still open to challenge.
But Ed, in your case, as it were, as you said from the outset, one of those elements was missing. And you didn't feel you had enough of the other element, if you like, the rational reason for believing to warrant continuing to believe it. So I can understand, in a sense, why you lost your faith
absolutely.
In that way. But what would it take for you to actually become a Christian again, let's say? Because we've asked Oz, would anything be enough to shake his faith or take it away? What would it be for you? Would it have to be actually an experience
obviously I'm now thoroughly flavoured by my current worldview, but if I had an amazing religious experience, that would
But hang on a minute,
up.
Doesn't your worldview tell you that that's bound to be a result of chemicals and it'll be some kind of an illusion, just like free will? So could at this point, I'm wondering, even that convince
you? Yeah, that's
you?
Because, right.
Because
it would
you're,
be a
you're
massive
going to be
hurdle.
Sceptical about
yes.
it, aren't you?
And then equally miracles in the same way, that it would sort of shake me up. But I've got a worldview in that you assess all evidence and you then check that your worldview fits it. And when the worldview doesn't fit the evidence anymore, then that's when you start looking for mm-hmm. alternatives.
And I was arguing, Ed, at the beginning, that two ways, if we could talk for a lifetime, know each other well, one would be negative, as you began to see the logical consequence of living consistently to your worldview, things would arise. If, for example, you say life is totally meaningless, you'll come across things this week, you'll falsify that. And the other would be experiences in your life which will puncture and point beyond what you're believing. Again, my friend calls them signals of transcendence. It's one of the reasons C.S. Lewis is surprised by joy. He couldn't explain joy as an atheist, and it made him a seeker. If we knew, you can't answer these sort of things in a one-hour
no,
program.
No, of course.
If we knew each other longer, Ed, those are the sort of things I would hope get to know you and love you and press you to see some of those. In other words, you have a confirmation bias the way I potentially do too.
Let's leave the last word to Ed as we start to wrap things up. Ed, we've come kind of full circle almost to talking about this aspect of experience and so on. But I mean, it sounds like you haven't closed the door on God altogether. Would that be fair to say?
That's right. But it's only kind of a chink of light coming through there.
But it is light.
I mean. Do you feel like you're in a position now where you feel quite free to address these questions and to ask, okay, an experience might do it, though that still has question marks over whether you could trust your experience given your current worldview. But, you know, do you feel like you've thoroughly examined all the evidence that is out there for God? Do you feel to your satisfaction?
Yeah, very, very. You know, all the big arguments I've thought out for hours and hours.
And in a sense, you feel you've given yourself the best case for, but you've never come to the conclusion that it warrants belief in God.
That's right. They're all heart based on the same thing about kind of meaning for life. There must be meaning.
Well, those aren't the only evidence. I'm thinking of things like the moral argument, which we touched on briefly today, argument from beauty, the cosmological argument, the argument from fine-tuning.
Yeah.
Many of these arguments that many would say provide, if you like, in their entirety, a universe which seems to be crying out for an explanation of some kind that points beyond itself. But you've satisfied, you've looked through all of those.
Yes, that's right. And at heart, there's subjectivity behind every single one of them.
Isn't that true of any worldview, though? The atheist worldview also has subjectivity at some level built in.
Probably. I haven't thought through the. I have to sort of email in an answer to that.
Okay. You put your hand up to wanting to insert one last point.
My wife grew up in an atheist family and came to faith in her early 20s. The turning point for her, she just couldn't make sense of anything or find God. And finally she prayed, "Oh God, if you're there at all, I can't find you. Please find me." And he did, in remarkable ways. And you're still open, Ed, to making a prayer like that your prayer.
I pray a lot.
Yeah.
I'll pray it now if you want to make an atheist praying on your show.
No, I think that's an honest prayer. And my wife's was, and God found her.
Okay. Well, look, it's been interesting, really interesting to hear your journey so far, Ed. Perhaps we'll get you on again to at some point down the line.
Yeah, I love all this stuff. And, you know, if there's anyone around the Thames Valley or something who wants to...
You've got a kind of discussion group that you're engaged
in. Discussion group. We like being small because it means we can all talk.
Well, I'll make sure there's some way of getting in touch with you via the website. And so anyone who's really interested in that, we'll make sure to...
No, yes. I promise that I'll come.
Or if there's some event where they want atheist to sort of stick up themselves or whatever.
You've certainly stuck up for yourself today. Thank you for being on, Ed. Lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
Really interesting discussion. And thanks, Oz, for being with us. And we look forward to seeing you again very shortly at Unbelievable, the conference on
Saturday.
Always
a pleasure. Thank you.
Great stuff. So make sure you check out today's show online and links to my guests and, of course, to more info on the conference where Oz will be speaking very shortly. Unbelievable, the conference 2014. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Thanks for listening. And we're going to be back with more of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming in just a moment's time.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Okay, well, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback in just a moment's time. Just a quick mention, though, if you're a regular keen follower of Unbelievable and you'd like to know a little more about the other things I do in my life here at Premier Christian Radio, well, our sister magazine, Premier Christianity, which is the leading non-denominational Christian magazine, monthly magazine here in the UK. I recently became senior editor of that, and it's been a real pleasure to get my feet under that particular desk and start to have a real hand in the features and the kinds of issues that we're dealing with in that magazine. If you want to check that out, we've got a brand new website that came online recently for the magazine, premierchristianity.com. And you can find a number of the articles that I've written as well for the magazine there. There's a special sort of apologetics section now in the magazine called Faith Explored, tying in to what we do every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio, where you can find my interviews with people like A.C. Grayling and Bart M. And others that we featured on Unbelievable over the years, as well as responses from apologists like Amy Orr Ewing and Chris Sinkinson and others. So premierchristianity.com if you want to check out some of the articles and features there. One of the most popular ones recently is my recent interview with Rick Warren, megachurch pastor, best-selling author, of course, and particularly a year on from the tragic suicide of his youngest son, Matthew. I sat down for about an hour with him, and you'll actually be hearing that as well on the profile in a couple of weeks' time if you want to listen out for that. But you can read it in the magazine, the latest edition of the magazine at premierchristianity.com. Okay, if you want to book in for this year's conference, time is running out, and I do encourage you to do that. We're so looking forward to all the people who will be joining me for Unbelievable, the conference 2014, Reasonable Faith in an Uncertain World. We're doing it with Biola University this year and in a partnership with Reasons to Believe. Both those organisations sending across some of their speakers. We've got William Lane Craig, Clay Jones, who was on the show last week, Craig Hazen, and of course, Jeff Swearing from Reasons to Believe, plus homegrown talent as well in the form of Oz Guinness, David Robertson, Tanya Walker and Ruth Jackson. Loads of seminars and types of things that they're contributing to. Check out the full lineup. You'll have trouble deciding which ones to attend. And the good thing is we are filming it this year and we'll be able to make you aware of how to get hold of the DVD after the conference too. So you can do that if you can't get to all of the seminars that are on offer this year. premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith to book in for Saturday the 12th of July, just 2 weeks away now, at Westminster Central Hall. As I've mentioned already, a free Reasonable Faith Debates DVD for every single delegate who comes along on the day. And of course, the free Biola Apologetics DVD if you book two or more tickets. What more can we give you for free? Well, you'll get a free copy of Christianity magazine there as well if you come along. So let's go to some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. Veronica wanted to say, about 2 weeks ago, I went to a wedding and met a gentleman in his 60s. He explained to me he was a scientist and how he longed to find God. We exchanged email addresses and I've encouraged him to listen to your programs. The following paragraph from his email probably shows you where he's at. He says, I've been flicking through my copy of The God Delusion by Professor Richard Dawkins, a confirmed atheist, who uses a phrase that probably sums me up at the moment, a deeply religious non-believer. Anyway, Veronica asks, I wondered if there are any books that you would recommend for him. Well, Veronica, if you are listening as well, as she's recommended the programme, I don't know your name, but then I could heartily recommend something like God's Undertaker by John Lennox, which is a great sort of introduction to reasons why science doesn't point away from God, but rather towards God. That might be a good place if he's a scientist. Equally, Francis Collins has some excellent books out. There are many others besides as well. So, but I think John Lennox is a good place to start. I do enjoy John and the way he puts things across. Tyler is getting in touch to say, I'm an atheist from St. Paul, Minnesota. Have to say you do a fantastically fair show, especially since you are a professing Christian. That said, I'd like to suggest a few show topics. Well, you've given me two ideas here. Firstly, aren't all of the theistic arguments actually just arguments for something with sufficient supernatural powers? If so, how do Christians narrow it down to the Christian God? How do Christians close the chasm between a handful of facts that they claim to have had a supernatural origin and the conclusion that the supernatural origin had to specifically be the God of Christianity? And then the second one that you suggest, which I think is very much related, you say some Christians couple theistic arguments for a general supernatural being with revelation, add in some faith and kablam, you have the Christian God. This brings me to the second question. How do we know that the revelations, either in the Bible or otherwise, are coming from the Christian God and not one of the infinite number of other possible supernatural beings? Okay, well, Tyler, I think it's evident that not all arguments point to the Christian God. Obviously, some arguments simply point to a creator of some kind. And that's often spelt out in very general terms. If you're talking about a cause for the universe, you're obviously not going to arrive at the God in all its Christian fullness. Having said that, I think for me, there are sort of other, you know, you'd move from those kind of more general arguments for some kind of transcendent cause to the universe or morality or whatever it might be, to specific arguments that God has been revealed in Jesus Christ fully. So that would be probably the argument for the resurrection would be a key one there if you're looking for an argument for that. If you've got a thought on this, I'd be interested to hear from you as well, especially on that second question. How do we know that the revelations in the Bible or otherwise are coming from the Christian God and not the infinite number of other possible supernatural beings? Well, I suppose, again, it's about looking at the evidence for whether the claims that are in the Bible to do with God and Jesus and so on make sense or have greater weight than claims of other religions and their supernatural beings. And I'd say, having examined those claims to some degree, fairly thoroughly, I remain convinced that Christianity has the best explanation, has the most going for it as far as having a revelation of the God who is behind this universe. But thank you for getting in touch as well. Let's go to some of those emails on suffering and evil, the debate between Clay Jones of Biola University and atheist philosopher Richard Norman. Chris says, thanks for a good debate. I thought Clay Jones came off very well. A couple of points that didn't come up. First, it's important to recognise that although suffering is a question that philosophers over the centuries have scratched their head about, for the man in the street, it's a relatively recent one. In past centuries, people just expected bad things to happen, including pestilence, disease, war, death in childbirth, high infant mortality, etc. In our modern and Western society, the advent of medical technology and pain-relieving drugs has made us start asking this question with a new intensity. We feel we almost have a right to a trouble-free life. Secondly, another good question we don't seem to ask, but maybe should, is why do good things happen? Why should there be mountain views, days at the seaside, job satisfaction, a welcoming smile, or even a sunny day? And why do many, many bad things not happen? That collision we narrowly avoided and that bug I didn't catch, why was that? Thanks for a stimulating discussion, says Chris. Stephen Portlock in Euston says, I didn't enjoy Saturday's show on evil, much to my surprise, given the high quality I usually expect from Unbelievable. To my mind, there are at least three philosophical faults in the question of why bad things happen to good people. But that comes from my reading of the likes of Eckhart Tolle, who was very helpful to me last December when my wife was dying. The problem of suffering, it seems to me, is just so massive that it would require an entire series of programs to sufficiently explore a Christian perspective on it. You say you're increasingly drawn to a Buddhist worldview. I still hold a flame for Christianity and am a churchgoer. While I personally suspect that the rather misunderstood teachings and possibly life of Jesus were primarily figurative and that he was a bodhisattva, my light wife was a devout Christian. Matt Rubenstein says, I think it's a shame you never got around to interrogating probably the single most important card in the theodicy deck, heavenly compensation. All the moral minuses in our world, Jones said, will be dwarfed by the pluses in the next one. But it hardly takes a degree in logic from Biola to ask yourself why it's not feasible for God to make a world where humans don't commit genocide. It's child play for him to reserve some of us a place in an afterlife filled with creatures who freely and unanimously do nothing bad for all eternity. I'm sure there's a theological magic trick to make this problem disappear, but I haven't heard it yet. Mike, on the other hand, says, as a listener since 2007, I think this is the best discussion on theodicy that I have heard, and so clearly demonstrated the double standard and faulty argument of the atheist position. Richard Norman uses logic and observation to determine that our current world is not the best world that a God could create, but when asked to describe a superior world, his only answer is that logically this is possible given an omnipotent God, but he's unable to give any hypothetical examples. So could an omnipotent God have logical reasons for the existence of evil? No, omnipotence can only be used to disprove God. The example of a world that will preserve free will and eradicate evil is the world to come, promised in the new heaven and new earth after judgment. And the only quibble I had with Clay Jones's argument on free will in heaven is to infer that without God changing our will in some way, that we will be able not to sin solely on the lessons that we have learned in this life. That was brought up by other people as well. There's a rather technical one as well here from Jonathan Rutledge on a sort of particular philosophical issue he had with Richard Norman's modal epistemology. I won't get into that now, but I will forward it to Richard because I think he'd be interested in reading that one, Jonathan. Loads more here, and I'm afraid I haven't got time to read many of them. But thank you for all the interest that programme last week has provoked in both directions, and I appreciate people getting in touch with me. If you want to do that yourself, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the place to do it. And do, of course, come back next week. We're going to be doing another discussion, and it'll just be a week from our conference. Let me tell you what's coming up then. You're unbelievable. We're looking at the Mormon Church, and we're going to be hearing from ex-Mormon Lynn Wilder as she debates Mormon apologist Michael Flournoy. It's another interesting discussion between a Christian and a non-Christian, although many Mormons call themselves Christians. But we're going to be debating that next week anyway. So I hope you can come back at the same time, same place. I've been Justin Brierley with you for Unbelievable. Coming up next, Tolu's here talking to Avery Sunshine on The Profile.